Hello, and welcome to the podcast, An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I'm your host, Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada. If you've been following the news in Canada over the past couple of weeks, you will have noticed that there, in fact, is one major story that has been getting a lot of attention in Canadian newspapers, online sites, on radio, on television, and just about everywhere else, for that matter. This issue is the fate of a man who has been dubbed Jihadi Jack, real name Jack Letts, who was born in the United Kingdom to a Canadian father and a British mother, who converted to Islam while a teen in the UK, traveled to the Middle East, we'll get back to that in a second, joined Islamic State, has been arrested, is now in Kurdish custody, and who wants to come home. He's changed his mind about Islamic State. In fact, he claims he was against the group from the beginning. We'll get back to that later as well. The problem is that he is being held by the Kurds, and the Kurds have made it quite known to a whole bunch of people that they don't have the wherewithal, the facilities, or the legalistic infrastructure to deal with these tens of thousands of Islamic State fighters and their families, i.e. their wives and children, and they want the Western powers, whence these people came in the first place, to take them home. The other complicating issue in this case is that Jihadi Jack, as the British media dubbed him, is no longer a UK citizen. The UK has stripped him of his UK citizenship, leaving him with his Canadian one. And this is where it gets interesting, in that Jack Letts is a Canadian through his father, who was born and raised in Canada. The younger Letts, in fact, has spent very little time in this country on vacation with his dad, and yet, because his UK citizenship has been removed, he has no recourse but to seek to come to Canada. And in fact, if you look at the statements that Jihadi Jack made, he was always very adamant that he wanted to return to the United Kingdom. It was only when that avenue was closed to him through the revocation of citizenship that he started talking about coming to my country. His dad, who is, I believe, separated or divorced from his from Jack's mother, has been pleading his case right across the country. He has gone to media in a variety of formats, begging Canada to help his son. He wants to rescue his son from Islamic State. And he has even offered to debate Andrew Scheer, who is the leader of the Conservative Party, the opposition party in Canada. Mr. Scheer has stated quite categorically that he does not think Jack Letts should come back to Canada, and John Letts, Jack's father, has offered to engage in an actual televised debate with Mr. Scheer to plead his case. Not coincidentally, we are on the cusp of an election here in Canada, whereby Mr. Scheer's party will be trying very hard to win the election, and going back to the previous election where Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party ousted Stephen Harper's Conservative Party, which had been in power for almost a decade. And Mr. Scheer, of course, wants to get back into power. So these are all sort of the circumstantial things that are surrounding this issue. What I want to address in greater detail, though, in this podcast is whether or not we should repatriate foreign fighters to our homelands. And more importantly, if we do so, is there any realistic chance of a successful prosecution in our countries? So let's start with just some basic facts. We know that Islamic State had an incredible attractive power in 2013, 2014, 2015. Estimates I have seen as high as 40,000, what we call foreign fighters. They've been called foreign terrorist fighters. They've been called high-risk travelers. There's all kinds of phrases out there to describe these people. Essentially, what we're talking about are individuals who deliberately, consciously, and purposefully made the decision to leave their country and go join Islamic State. These 40,000 people apparently represent more than 100 countries. More than half the countries on earth happen to be the home of individuals who sought to fight for Islamic State. In some countries, the rates are quite significant. In Tunisia, for example, I have seen figures as high as 6,000 Tunisians went to fight for Islamic State. Thousands went from Central Asia. Thousands went from a variety of European countries. In Canada, the number of so-called foreign fighters, as far as we know in the public domain, is somewhere around a couple hundred. Now, that figure has never been made clear. It doesn't only refer to Islamic State, I don't think. It refers to other terrorist groups, nor does it refer to a time frame. But on the whole, 200 or so Canadians are believed to have left Canada deliberately, as I noted earlier, to fight with a terrorist group. And of that figure, it is estimated, again, very generally, as a lot of the data is not in the public domain. Not surprisingly, it's probably with CSIS and the RCMP, Security Intelligence Service, and Federal Law Enforcement Agency. It is surmised that about a third, 60 or so, are believed to be dead, killed in airstrikes, drone strikes, military action, etc. 60 or so have been returned to Canada, or rather have returned to Canada. And that's a fascinating figure that I should really pick up on later on. And 60 are being held in some kind of incarceration somewhere in the Middle East or Africa, wherever whatever terrorist group they sought to join. And the debate is now whether or not Canada should make any effort to repatriate these people. The government has made it quite clear that its position is based in law and that the Canadian government has no legal obligation to repatriate anybody. That's a position that I happen to support. Some have argued we have a moral obligation. That's a very nebulous term as far as I'm concerned. I'm not sure what it means. But one thing is certain, and that under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, essentially our Constitution, every Canadian has a right to leave the country, and every Canadian has a right to return to this country, meaning that if people like Jack Letts or the other 60 or so Canadians believed to have left to join terrorist groups eventually makes his or her way back to Canada, i.e. without the government help, we have no choice but to take them in. They have a charter right to return. What happens then? Well, we're going to get to that. But I want to return to the question of whether or not government should actively repatriate their citizens. Those who've argued in favor have made a couple of points. They have essentially stated that we as Canadians, as Canada, have a duty to help citizens abroad. We have a duty not to foist our problems, i.e. our terrorists radicalized in Canada, left Canada with this intent. We can't leave them to the devices of foreign courts, foreign prisons, and foreign governments. That's an unfair burden to be placed on countries who may be strapped in terms of the number of terrorist prisoners they have to bring to trial. And there's the argument that Canadians and others are in fact subjected to torture when they're being held in incarceration. And when they get to trial, that some of these trials are in fact nothing short of kangaroo courts. Very rapid trials, a couple of minutes in length, and invariably the sentence that is issued by the court is death, or a very long prison term. And as we in Canada do not have capital punishment, those in favor of repatriation, i.e. the government taking steps to repatriate Canadians, have argued that we have a duty to rescue Canadians from capital punishment. This is a really interesting argument. Personally, I do not believe in capital punishment, but my position is that who am I as a Canadian to tell the Iraqis or the Syrians or the Singaporeans, who, by the way, execute for drug use, who am I to tell them how to run their system? Who am I to tell them what laws to apply? Who am I to tell them what punishments are the appropriate ones for their justice system? In this case, in Iraq and Syria, participation in the activities of a terrorist group is punishable by death. Again, I don't agree with it, but that's what Iraqis and Syrians have decided. So the argument that we need to save Canadians from this horrific fate, I think, is on very, very tenuous legal grounds and not much better moral grounds. Many Canadians that I've spoken to over the past couple of weeks, and I've done a ton of media on Jihadi Jack and foreign fighters, are of the opinion they made their bed, it's time to lie in it. I.e., they made a conscious choice to join a terrorist group, and why are we even lifting a finger? In fact, Andrew Scheer, the aforementioned leader of the Conservative Party, stated quite definitively he will not raise a finger to help Jihadi Jack or any other Canadian who's incarcerated abroad for terrorism. So that's where the public opinion lies. The other wrinkle in all of this is that Canada, in recent years, has been subject to a variety of judicial inquiries and lawsuits and has made massive multi-million dollar payments to Canadians who were incarcerated abroad and who could prove, or rather convince the courts, that in fact Canada was somehow complicit in their incarceration and in their maltreatment, i.e. torture abroad. And as a result, we have paid out, last count, about $50 million to five different people. And there's another lawsuit, which I think is $27 million, which is still outstanding, of a Canadian terrorist who was in Sudan. So I think the government is also very aware that If we don't choose to act now, the courts may find us negligent as a state and thereby impose large fines. In this sense, and the thinking might be, well, let's bring them back now before we pay out $10 million. Because I can tell you, again, going back to public reaction, nobody in Canada supports these payments, or very, very few people. They think it's an abomination that we as taxpayers are paying out millions of dollars to Canadians who chose to join terrorist groups. That's what Canadians think. What the courts say, what the government says, are different things. Getting back to this notion of repatriation, though, there's an important element that I think people are missing. One of the arguments is that we repatriate them, we charge them when they come to Canada, we take them to court, we try them, and we incarcerate them as terrorists. And that's all well and good, if you can do that. A recent article in the Globe and Mail, in which I was cited a little bit, states that the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, has told a journalist from the Globe, Janice Dixon, that in fact they are not sending any officers to Syria or Iraq to gather evidence that can be used in court to charge and try Canadian foreign fighters. It's understandable why the RCMP is not doing this. There is the safety issue, although I really do think that the Canadian government, particularly Ralph Goodale, the Minister of Public Safety, has really oversold this public safety issue. A lot of journalists, I know some, academics, I know some, have traveled to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan, northern Syria, and interviewed foreign fighters who are sitting in prison. So if a journalist and an academic can make it, I'm pretty sure a consular official or a law enforcement officer could in fact make the trip to those areas to carry out some kind of either interrogation or arrange for these people to be extradited, I guess that's the wrong term, returned back to Canada to face charges here. The other issue is that the RCMP has already been burned quite badly, as has CSIS, in recent past for having collaborated or worked with the Syrian and Iraqi intelligence and law enforcement services. Hence the multi-million dollar payouts that I talked about before. Four of the five who received payouts were linked to torture in Syria. Can you imagine in 2019 the RCMP saying, yeah, we'll go to Damascus and talk to the Syrians? Of course not. The assumption is that the Syrians use torture, and I'm pretty sure they do. And thereby the RCMP or any other government agency cannot be seen to be cavorting with the Syrians for the reasons I've already cited. Secondly, we as a country also, and many countries, recognize that gathering evidence and or information under torture is highly unreliable. So any information the Syrians or Iraqis could provide us with would be questionable at best. So it's for these reasons, I think, that the RCMP has chosen not to send people abroad to aid in the investigation of Canadians who are incarcerated for having joined a terrorist group. Whether or not they're being investigated here, the RCMP, not surprisingly, has said, don't ask, don't tell. I'd be very surprised if there were not investigations ongoing, either by the RCMP or by my former colleagues at CSIS, on Canadians who've come back from Syria, Iraq, or any other war zone where they joined terrorist groups, to ascertain what threat to public safety these people have posed. There's no question that the threat is there. It's a potential threat. And even if historically a very small percentage of returning foreign fighters actually carries out or facilitates an act of terrorism, the fact remains that several have, and the Bataclan attacks in Paris in 2015 and the Brussels airport attack in 2018 are good examples whereby returning foreign fighters did exactly that. So of course CSIS and the RCMP are going to have a look at these people who return to ascertain, do they pose a threat? And more importantly, can we in fact gather evidence to use in a court case? But this is where it becomes really difficult, because you can certainly gather evidence here in Canada. You can run human sources or agents, you can do surveillance, you can get a court-appointed warrant to intercept communications, voice, email, Twitter, WhatsApp, etc., etc. And if you're lucky, you'll gain enough evidence through that process, those variety of sources, to actually go to the Crown, the prosecution in Canada, and say, here's our case. We think it's strong enough to go to court, lay charges under Section 83.1, etc., of the Canadian Criminal Code, and charge these folks with terrorism. The problem is that the best evidence, the best information, is probably back in Syria and Iraq. The eyewitnesses that may in fact be able to associate, link these Canadians with actual acts of terrorism. Raping Yazidi girls, throwing gays off buildings, shooting people on the head, all the things that Islamic State is well known to have done. Those people are all back in Syria and Iraq. And if the RCMP is not, in fact, taking the chance to go there to collect evidence, then that evidence won't be heard. And I would ascertain that that evidence, those eyewitnesses, are the best guarantee, maybe guarantee is too strong a word, are the best plan going forward to go to court, testify against these terrorists, and gain convictions. So again, it's not that the domestic investigations are not useful, and in some cases, you may in fact see a prosecution. Although I will point out that to the best of my knowledge, and we're speaking here at the end of August 2019, I don't know of a single Canadian who's been charged in a Canadian court with having left Canada to join a terrorist group. So if there are 60 or so odd Canadians who've returned and not a single one's been charged, that tells you something. That tells you that the Crown, the prosecution, is not confident the cases are strong enough. And I've learned through my time at CSIS and the Canadian government that the Crown does not want to waste its time going after the small fish against whom they will not gain a conviction. So that seems to illustrate to me that in no case has there been that critical mass of evidence that's good enough to go to court, have a trial, and come up with a conviction. So what does this mean? Well, it means that if you do go to court, and as I already noted, in many cases, they're choosing not to go to court. But if you do go to court with not the best case in mind, you relied on evidence collected here in Canada, you don't have access to the eyewitnesses, you don't have access to social media in Iraq and Syria that can be used in court, then your chances of conviction are lower, meaning your chances of acquittal are much higher. Imagine the outrage here in Canada if a whole bunch of people who came back from Iraq and Syria or Somalia, having fought with Al-Shabaab, or Nigeria, having fought with Boko Haram, or to Afghanistan, having fought with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever. Imagine a bunch of Canadians have come home, they've been met at the border, so the Canadian government repatriated them, it sent a plane to get them, it brought them back here, they get off the plane, they're charged, they're brought to court, the trial ensues, and because of a lack of evidence, they all are acquitted. Every single one of them. Imagine the reaction of Canadians. Canadians are already pissed off that Omar Khadr got $10.5 million for his sojourn in Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, was the Americans' fault, not Canada's fault. I cannot imagine the rage and the anger that the vast majority of Canadians would demonstrate to having all these terrorists essentially walk scot-free. That's number one. Secondly, if in fact we cannot carry out successful prosecutions against Canadian returning foreign fighters, what message does it send to the next generation of wannabes? Well, it tells them pretty simply, you can leave Canada, you can go fight with the next instantiation of Islamic State, 2.0, 3.0, I've lost count which 0.0 we're at. And if you come back, you know what? You're not going to pay any penalty because the state's not going to be in a position to gain a conviction on what you did over there. So where's the harm? Where's the damage? Where's the risk to you as an individual? Risk being, of course, you could get droned or airstriked out of existence. But if you go over there and survive and come back, there's a good chance you either will not be brought to trial because of lack of evidence, or if you are in fact brought to trial, that you'll be acquitted. This is a really bad message to send to people who are maybe entertaining the possibility of joining terrorist groups down the road. All this to say, those who are calling for repatriation followed by prosecution, I think are missing the point. I was on a radio show a few weeks ago, and one of the guests, who is a professor in Toronto, said, well, these court cases would be slam dunks. First of all, when you work in intelligence, you don't use the term slam dunk. George Tenet taught us that with Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Remember that? Secondly, they're not slam dunks. These are not easy cases to prosecute for the reasons I've already cited. So if we can't repatriate them to bring them to court, prosecute them, and gain convictions, then we run the risk of bringing them back and then they go free. Which, again, leads to Canadian anger and leads to giving the bad message to future wannabe jihadis. Where does that leave us then? Well, where it leaves us is where we are right now. The Canadian government of Justin Trudeau has stated it will do nothing to facilitate the return of Jack Letts, as it has no legal obligation to do so, and by extension, no other Canadian who is fighting with a terrorist group abroad. You can bet the mortgage that the Liberal government will do nothing to on this file at all until after the election, if then, because if Jack Letts were to come home on the Canadian taxpayers' dime between now and the vote in October, I'm pretty sure that would be the nail in the coffin of Justin Trudeau's desire to win a second term as Prime Minister in Canada. So this issue is going nowhere really quickly. For those of you in my audience who are Canadian, it's the ultimate Canadian riking the puck, which is what hockey teams do to waste time. This is what the Liberal government's doing. It's wasting time. If the Liberals return to power, there are some that I've spoken to who say they will cave and bring back Jack Letts and everybody else. Perhaps, you know, that remains to be seen. Andrew Scheer, Conservative, has said quite categorically he won't do that. So we'll have to wait and see as to what happens after Canadians go to the polls in October and what governments return as to what the policy is going to be with respect to Canadians who fought with terrorist groups abroad. What I'm trying to suggest with this podcast is that the best solution, and this is really the least worst of a whole series of possible solutions, is to leave these people where they are. If necessary, they will go through horrendous trials in Iraq and Syria, whereby the trials will not be fair. Some may be executed. Some may get long prison sentences. But I return to the point I made earlier. These are decisions made by mature, conscious individuals who thought that joining a terrorist group was a good idea. And as my mother always taught me, sometimes bad decisions have bad consequences. I don't feel a lot for these people, and I don't think most Canadians do either. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens in the election. We'll see what happens in terms of Canadian policy going forward, whether there's a change in the way in which we deal with this phenomenon. The sad part is that the phenomenon's not going away. Several hundred Canadians are still abroad, and I can guarantee you the next time a jihadi group, or any other group for that matter, raises the banner saying, we want you to fight, let me think of the old Uncle Sam posters for the U.S. military, Canadians will go, as will Brits and Australians and Americans and Belgians and French and Swiss, etc. So the issue of our citizens leaving to join terrorist groups is not one that's going to disappear tomorrow. So we'll have to keep hashing out what to do with these people and look at all the consequences and all the complications of policies and procedures and threat to public and the possibility of court trials and the probability of convictions, and all this is going to get thrown into the mix. So my advice to you is, you know, just wait and see. This debate is not over, and you're going to hear a lot more about it, and I'd be very skeptical if any one country comes up with a really good solution to this. So that's it for podcast 18. I hope you enjoyed it. You can hear the podcast on a variety of social media, on Podbean, on YouTube, on my webpage, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. As usual, I would love to hear what you think of the content of this podcast, as well as to suggest material for future podcasts. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com, or on Twitter, @borealissaves. You can also reach me on LinkedIn, on Facebook, or on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again in a fortnight. Until then, stay safe.